Hey there, friends. Welcome to the Book Spider podcast, an intellectually stimulating literary analysis program that follows a book of the week format. I'm Patrick Barney, one of your hosts, and with me, as always, are my two co-hosts.
Hi, I'm Hans Berger.
Hi, I'm Chris Malmberg.
This episode, we're discussing Gate of the Sun, a harrowing novel of the decades-long occupation of Palestine by Israel, written by Elias Koury. Before we go into further detail, though, I chose this book because, you know, we're dealing with a massive humanitarian crisis and genocide in Gaza right now. So before we discuss the novel, I'd like to observe a minute of silence in remembrance of the 1,200 Israeli civilians killed on October 7th. The 30,000 innocent Gazans killed since then, and Aaron Bushnell, the young American serviceman who gave his life in a tragic act of solidarity with the Palestinians. So, as I said, Gate of the Sun is a harrowing novel featuring tale upon tale of men, women, and children whose homes have been destroyed, whose loved ones have been killed, whose entire lives have been upended by the chaos of violence and occupation. The frame that surrounds all of these stories of trauma is the seemingly intertwined fates of Khalil. Khalil is probably a better way to say it. Who is a med student playing doctor in a ramshackle medical facility in a refugee camp near Beirut, Lebanon, and Yunus, an old Palestinian freedom fighter who is languishing in a coma after a stroke. Though his colleagues have told Khalil to give up hope, he nevertheless spends his days at Yunus's bedside telling stories of Yunus's life as a resistance fighter, of Yunus's relationship with Nahela, the wife that he left behind, and of Khalil's own life as a soldier, medical student, doctor, and most importantly, lover of Shems, a fierce, independent woman who is now dead, murdered by the family members of Salim, whom Shems herself murdered. As Khalil tells these stories to the comatose Yunus, other stories of innumerable family members and acquaintances also surface, portraying scene by scene the trauma that occupation creates in their lives. And haunting the whole novel is the Gate of the Sun, Bab el-Shems, the cave that Yunus returns to time after time to meet Nahela and eke out a strange romance over the years. So that's my summary of the novel. Like, it's huge. It's a big novel. There are so many storylines and threads, and maybe there aren't that many storylines, but there are so many different threads branching out in so many different directions, because, you know, Khalil will tell a story to comatose Yunus, and the story will feature a relative who will then tell a story about a relative, and you have, it's not, there aren't like stacked stories, but there are stories of so many different people within the overall frame that it can become quite confusing, and it's hard to say like what Other than the frame, it's hard to say what whether there's another unifying story at all.
It's also a little bit more confusing, I think, for Western readers. You know, I mean, this was published in, I think, 1998, and mostly seems to be taking place maybe 10 years. I mean, the core frame, I think, is sometime before that even. And it's, I mean, I have some knowledge of the history of Israel and Palestine, but like a lot of it gets into, for instance, the civil war in Lebanon,
right,
which, frankly, I don't know a whole lot about. So there's an extra level of confusion, too, I think, for a contemporary Western reader who's not particularly deeply familiar with the history of the of various conflicts in the Middle East.
Yeah, before reading this, I decided that I should at least have some idea of the history of the Israel-Palestine conflict. So, you know, some historical moments that are of importance are like Mandatory Palestine, which was this British protectorate during World War One and a little bit after, and which was never technically a state. It was, you know, overseen by Palestinians. And then after World War II, we've got the creation of Israel as a state and the Nakba, which is the first conflict between Israel and Palestinians. And then from there, you've got several more wars between Israel and neighboring states like Lebanon and Syria. And then you've got also conflicts between Israel and Palestinians. So, yeah, you're absolutely right, Hans. There's, like, a huge history there that, like, I only briefly glanced at it to kind of see, like, to at least have some of the words in my head as I was listening to this novel. It
seems to be written for an audience that is assumed to have a much higher level of familiarity with that than I did, at least, frankly.
Right. And what I think is interesting, since we're already talking about history and what the history of the conflict is, I singled out three main concepts that the book deals with that I want to talk about each in turn. But since we're already talking about history, let's talk about what the novel's concept of history is. So there are several statements that seem to be directly about the nature of history in the novel. So like history is an illusion. History lies or history is lying. History is blind. History isn't in the land. It's in us, meaning Palestinians. I think that's said by Eunice. So I'm kind of interested in a couple of things. So what are the ways in which this novel represents? What are the ways in which this novel represents these statements about history? And does the novel make these statements sincerely? Like, is it sincerely saying history is an illusion, or is it more of a they're trying to get a more granular idea? You know, maybe not history is just an illusion, but do you know what I'm saying?
I do know what you're saying. I don't know if I can say with confidence one way or another, right? I mean, I think that like the accumulation of detail in this novel is so intense. The accumulation of historical detail, the accumulation of character detail, the accumulation of all the kinds of little bits of character moment that aren't connected to conflict or war, and the accumulation of horror, and it's just such a enormous mass of history and violence and all those different kinds of things that are kind of put together. And I find myself a little bit powerless in the face of it to try to extract any kind of clear statement either about the particulars of the conflict or about the kind of broader, any kind of broader idea. Honestly, I just it's a bit overwhelming in that regard, and I don't know that there are certainly times when characters kind of seem to mouthpiece ideas like the ones that you're pointing to, but, you know, to whether that idea about history should be taken as literally the didactic statement of the novel or whether it's just a character's perspective in the moment that's not endorsed, I just don't have the faintest, frankly.
Well,
and maybe that is thematic, right? Maybe that sense of confusion, maybe the way in which the kind of mass of the thing eludes easy analysis, maybe that is in fact deliberate, right? Maybe that's a feature and not a bug, but maybe that's just an easy out for, you know, not being qualified for whatever as a matter of you know, pre-existing knowledge or philosophical depth or whatever, just being defeated a little bit by the novel.
Did you have anything to add on that topic, Chris?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm in a similar boat as Hans. And honestly, the question as you'd written it reminded me more of a kind of trait of Khalil as a narrator that I didn't highlight any of them. And so I'm kind of mashing them together in my memory, but he will sort of ram different kind of he will cram these grand statements together about there's definitely at least one or if not two about death, like they were dead but we were alive, and then like the next sentence would be actually, we were all dead. And, you know, he does that several times.
Yeah.
He does that with, I did highlight this about lies. Shemps, you know, said that she would never lie to me. She said that she'd lie to her husband and felt there was no reason to lie to me. There's a long sort of statement there, but of course I was lying to her. I used the phrase an innocent relationship so I could sleep with her. We lie so because we can't find the words. Words don't indicate specific things, which is why everyone understands them as they wish. I have no right to call, and he says that she raped him, and then later I have no right to call that rape, so I withdraw what I said and I apologize.
Right.
And there's a way in which it's not grand statements, and I don't know necessarily how to say it, but I guess like he will make statements and describe things and then describe them in an entirely different way that seems to kind of cut across what he has said previously, and then it'll kind of blow up. And there's a kind of almost a flattening effect where it does feel like the distinction between sort of like gradation of something like rape or lying or death kind of goes away. It sort of washes away into this very confusing space. And it did seem that's what occurred to me, you know, sort of reading your question and thinking about your question about history. And there is, like Hans suggested, an intentional resonance there with what history is in this place for these people at this time.
Well, you just said something that I thought was really cool. You said like all of these grand abstract statements kind of wash away gradation. And I feel like there's a parallel or a mirror there in that violence itself does this, right? Like, you know, the trauma and the violence that just accumulate in this novel, they really do tend to wash away our ability, maybe not gradations themselves, but our ability to kind of see gradation, our ability to understand details and things like that. So that's interesting. And I actually want to point out that's something about the novel I really, really liked. I really like it when novels will make these grand statements but are kind of ambiguous. Like, you're not quite sure, like, is the grand statement a thing that's sincere, or is it ironic, or is it both sincere and ironic? I don't know. I thought they were pretty interesting, and sometimes they were even funny. Like, when what you were talking about, Chris, you know, he talks about, you know, Shemp's lying to him and he was lying to her, and, you know, I believed this, but I lied. And there was some humor there in a novel that, where humor can kind of be not as common as you'd like. I'll put it that way. Were there other things to be said about, you know, like, so the statement history is an illusion or history is blind. Were there specific areas where you thought this ideas like this were represented in an interesting way?
There was a passage that I, somewhere around page 200 and something. There's a passage where he, I believe it's the narrator speaking. I took a photo of it with my phone. He says, "We found justifications for the criminal error that we'd committed. We said we were taking revenge for the massacres. That was when I became convinced that self-criticism was useless, since everything will be found to have its motives, its pretexts, its special circumstances, and so on." And that seemed like a very interesting, I don't know, like that kind of jumped out at me as meaningful in a way that a lot of other things didn't, right? That idea that, and I guess there's kind of a nihilism to it in the context of a book about a conflict like this, right? Where, you know, it's, well, I don't know, maybe it's problematic to say that it's hard to define clear heroes and villains, but I think, like, it's, how do you move on from a conflict like this, right? One way that I think you have to is self-criticism and self-critique and the admitting of fault and the assertion there that actually can't be done because of kind of the endless cycles of self-justification. I don't know if I can connect that to a bigger thread other than just it's one way in which I think the novel kind of undercuts the idea of history,
right?
Or undercuts the idea that history can be meaningful, and one of maybe the most poignant ways that it undercuts the idea that history can be meaningful.
And the cycle of self-justification, you know, the cycle of self-justification certainly seems pertinent to the actual historical conflict, since, you know, a lot of the time, you know, what we do, you know, people will, well, this happened this time, so I'm justified in doing this. And then the other side, you know, it's like tit for tat retaliation that kind of ends up just to, going nowhere, you know.
Right, exactly.
So, and maybe that's a way in which history lies, or history is blind, history is an illusion. If we have tit for tat retaliation and no one can determine who's in the right and no one can determine who's in the wrong, then we just have this cyclical process of violence and revenge that, you know, has no evolution. So, like, there have been various people who have said who have said this idea, but maybe no one as more poignantly than Martin Luther King, who said the moral arc of the universe is long, but it tends towards justice. And now I'm not going to say that this novel disagrees with that idea, but it certainly seems to present a situation in which, like, if we tried to say that about this situation, it doesn't seem like it would be true. You know, the at least insofar as this idea of cycles of retaliation is concerned.
Right.
So how about this, you know, moving on to another idea. How about this idea of, you know, I referenced revenge. So how about this idea of Khalil comparing himself to Hamlet, which he obviously brings up the idea of, you know, the Shakespeare play and how Hamlet knows that his father has been killed by his uncle. And so there's a royal fratricide, and, you know, he spends the whole play thinking about revenge, plotting revenge, and yet can't ever seem to do anything until, you know, the final bloody act. So what is this comparison? Like, is Khalil right? Like, is he right to compare himself to Hamlet? And if he is, you know, what else does this reveal about the novel?
Well, he does quite more often than I think I'd consider normal imagine killing the people he cares about. He talks about smothering Eunice with a pillow, and then he's on several occasions describes killing, he should have been the one to kill Shemps.
Right.
And I even wondered if he did toward the end, like that was going to be like a sort of a revelation that, like, it seemed almost like it was hinted at that, like, this idea of like Shemps dying and him being heartbroken was covering up the fact that, like, he'd actually been the one to kill her. Because he does seem to suggest that, like, people want revenge for her death on him.
Right.
Which I don't think I understand that he did. But there's a lot about this novel, like Hans said, that I have a hard time, like...
It was my understanding that they wanted to kill him as part of, like, the blood debt, since he was known to be Shemps's lover. I think that's why they wanted to kill him, right? I think they actually may have actually believed that he killed her.
Yeah, I think that's hinted at. Yeah, and
right.
And then there's a couple times because he's speaking, like, this is written in a way that is suggestive of basically, like, suggestive. This is written as though he is speaking out loud, and because he is speaking out loud, he has occasion to ramble into like sort of down alleys in his narrative that he then kind of like fights his way back out of, and they sort of hint at, I think the way that I came away from it, that he feels kind of guilty, and in his guilt for not for things that he did but for things that maybe he felt or feels about Shemps and, like, her betrayal, that he's as good as her killer, since there is certainly a significant part of him right now that, at least talks about wanting to kill her. So And going back to Hamlet, like, I don't know, there's an impotent rage and he's
right.
a sense of incredible wrongness in him. Like, what is he supposed to do? How is he supposed to
right.
get recompense for the innumerable ways that he's been wronged? And yet he feels guilt for things that he hasn't done.
Right.
So I think that that's Hamlet-ish.
And I thought that was also interesting what you just said, Chris. You said, you pointed out that there's no real way for him to get recompense for anything, which seems to... I don't know, like, I don't know if that's the point of Hamlet, the play. Like, I don't know, like, I would need to reread Hamlet to get it fresher in my mind. But certainly, you know, Khalil can't get recompense for any of the wrongs that have ever been done to him, which certainly seems to go back to that idea we were discussing just a little bit ago about the pointless cycle of violence, which fixes nothing and only makes certain to keep it broken, right?
Yeah, and I think that there is there is a kind of, I don't know exactly how to unpack it, but this idea of revenge being the brave path and Khalil feeling like he is something of a coward. And so I guess like, you know, Hamlet doesn't consider himself a Hamlet. If you consider yourself a Hamlet, you're kind of labeling yourself for the sort of like impotent traits that Hamlet
right.
does not perceive in himself. Khalil perceives those in himself.
Right.
And so like, you know, he's not a Hamlet because you don't get the privilege of naming your pathology. But I think that he is sort of like, hung up on a perception of himself as a kind of a coward for not being the one to kill Shemps, you know, for not
right.
being a, you know, a better soldier, for not, you know, for, you know, many things.
Sure. Did you want to add anything to that, Hans?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Fair enough. I'm not certain what else to say about him, the comparison to Hamlet either. I don't know if there's a deeper, like any deeper theme to draw out other than Khalil does seem, and he recognizes this himself, he does seem to have traits that Hamlet, the character in the Shakespeare play, also has: desire for revenge and impotence to carry out that revenge. And other than that, I'm not sure what particular thematic statement the novel might make about it.
I do think that Hamlet is itself kind of an ambiguous
right,
text,
sure.
Right? Like the question of why is Hamlet. Is Hamlet a dithering teenager? Is Hamlet, is the ghost lying? I don't know. Like, it might be that I overcomplicate Hamlet because my first experience of it was in a grad school class where, you know, the professor took great joy in pointing out all the ways that Hamlet is strange and
right.
mysterious. But, like, I mean, I think there are, like, Hamlet is to some extent, there are a lot of different ways to read what the character does and why he does what he does. And I think that ambiguity is maybe more important for providing a space for Khalil to define himself than it is for, you know, an absolute one-to-one kind of correspondence between the two.
Sure. Absolutely. So let's head over to the third concept that I think is present in this novel and which is extremely interesting. So the novel uses some variation on the phrase victims and executioners, I think a minimum of four times, maybe more. So I'm almost positive that this is a reference to the series of essays that Albert Camus wrote and published in the resistance newspaper Combat, which he edited during World War II. So in 1946, the context surrounding these newspaper articles written by Camus is that in 1946, the newly restored government of France was undertaking trials and extrajudicial purges to punish members of the VC, the Vichy, and other Nazi collaborators. So at first, Camus was like, yes, let's do this. Let's ferret out these collaborators and make sure that they are punished. However, as these punishments kept going, Camus believed that the fervor that they had risen to have just went way too far. So, you know, maybe, for example, maybe someone who had once publicly professed to be a Nazi just to get out of maybe being shot. You know, this type of person who was not really a collaborator or only a collaborator in a very small way might have been thrown in prison or executed in the fervor of the purges. So Camus like, no, we've got to stop this. This is too far. So his response was this series of articles, and he says, you know, yes, collaborators were wrong, but at this point, we have to rebuild, we have to forgive and reintegrate, and it's time that we are, it's okay to resist oppression, it's okay not to be a victim, but it's not okay to go to the other side and become a murderer. You know, so that's where the title comes from, neither victim nor executioner. And if you're a Camus fan like I am, he has another work, a play called Le Juste, which deals with the assassination of a Russian aristocrat, that in which he kind of comes to the same idea. So obviously, when this novel is saying victim and executioner, victim or executioner a number of times, I'm wondering, is it referencing this idea of Camus to come to a similar conclusion, like violence is horrible, there's nothing else to do but reconcile, like we just have to stop this and reconcile, or would you say maybe the response is angrier, like, no, let's not reconcile, let's keep this cycle going?
I mean, you know, once again, the novel is so, there's so much in it, and it goes in so many different directions, and it has so much of a kind of whirlwind quality that I don't know if I can really advance an argument based on just what's in the text of the novel, right? I mean, I think that it's I want it to mean what you're meaning, right? Like, I want it to reach the same conclusion as Camus, because, like, just at a kind of gut level, that's what I want to be true. And I don't, if the if the assertion of this novel is, no, let's continue to have a cycle of righteous violence, then I don't really want to be endorsing it on this podcast. You know? But I, like, I certainly hope that what you're seeing is in fact a conscious aesthetic strategy to try to endorse a viewpoint that I would agree with. But I can't begin to, you know, if somebody else who knew the novel better than me could demolish me in argument if they happened to take a different perspective. I don't know if that's kind of an unsatisfying answer to what is a pretty observant and thoughtful question.
No, it's not. It's totally fair to say that this is a tough novel. And it is, like, this is a tough novel.
Yeah.
Like, not only, it's not exactly, like, I think the form is interesting, but the fact that Khalil it just kind of can go off into whatever anecdotal thread that he wants makes it hard to not hard to follow, but hard to put your ideas into a coherent form, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard since we have dozens of different characters giving different testimonies and different stories. So it's fine to say this is hard, and I'm just not sure. I'm not sure either, which is why I asked the question, and my response is the same as Hans's. Now, I don't want to, you know, speaking more directly about reality, I don't want to make a I know what I feel, but I also don't want to necessarily anger anybody else. You know, I know what I feel about the conflict going on in Israel and Palestine. I know who I think the aggressor is and who I think the victim is in this situation, at least like on a large scale. Obviously on the nitty gritty scale, you have people on both sides doing things that are immoral and horrible. But on a large scale, you know, you probably have to take the side of the people who are being oppressed. Well, not probably, you do. But at the same time, I also want this novel, like Hans said, to be for the idea of reconciliation, before the idea of ending violence. But again, I'm not sure either. Did you?
I mean, I don't think that it. It certainly isn't a forceful assertion of the need for reconciliation,
right.
And the end of violence. I don't think, right? Like, it's not. You're not coming away from it. If I don't know. I mean, I think like. If the point of choosing it for the podcast is to have it as a way of asserting or discovering the right thing to think about a real world event, I don't think it's do that for us, right? And if we want something that is a powerful argument in favor of any perspective on how to think about the conflict in 2024, it's just
right.
I think like we came to the wrong I know. I think you were maybe going to ask Chris a question.
I was just going to see if you had an answer, Chris, to this question, or if you're kind of in the dark like Hans and me.
I'm in the dark. I feel like what I want to do, because the novel as a whole is so much spaghetti.
That's a good word.
I had a favorite part of this novel, and it feels relevant to this question. And it's Hassan going back to her house in, I can't remember the name of the village, Al-Quik, Al-Kwaku. That's the other thing about this novel, is there's a lot of things that sound alike, and that's probably a Western bias in terms of, like, you know, or read similarly on the page. There's some names that are, like, occur and reoccur.
Right.
And it's just hard to really draw authoritative lines from, like, signs and between sign and signifier sometimes in this novel. Even, like, use of pronouns can get kind of hard. But the Hassan is visiting her old house that she's been, you know, that she has evacuated from, and now lives in the Shatila outside of Beirut. And there's a Jewish woman living there now, and they, you know, she gets, like, a tour of the house, and the Jewish woman's kind of cold or distant or aloof, and then Hassan says mentions that she's from Beirut, and the Jewish woman is like, oh my God, and calls her sister and says she misses Beirut, that's where she's from, she hates this place that she lives now, and they commiserate in it, and then suddenly the Jewish woman is like, okay, you can go now, and here, take your jug, it was here when I got here, and it's not mine, it's yours. And that was my favorite part of this novel, like, hands down. Mm-hmm. I was very moved by it. It had this unsettling, kind of awkward sort of, it was sort of, I don't know, like, there's a kind of domestic absurdity to it that's, like, kind of funny, even if it's, like, really sad. And so I think about that scene and your question, and I think the novel may be more observational than arguing anything, like, as far as, like, a suitable response or way to handle the situation. Here we have, like, this connection between these women that ultimately doesn't resolve anything.
Right.
You know, and I think it can illustrate, I think certainly this novel does not glorify violence. Like, it's definitely not doing that. It's definitely not it's definitely not celebrating this conflict. But I think it does, maybe for me, and I say this with about 20% confidence, suggest that a lot of the solutions that are out there are not really solutions, realistically.
Interesting.
Well, and I guess, like, no, I don't think that it's saying that. I don't know that it, so, like, the solution is coming from your question. I don't think that it really posits solutions. I think that it shows the nearness to, you know, to genuine connection in some cases that does not actually resolve in any kind of answer or
I think that's probably true, and actually resonates quite well with what I think is my favorite kind of area of the novel, which is where the French documentarian comes to the refugee camp, and they're asking Khalil, like, they're trying to get him to talk about the occupation and the trauma and all that. And he's not really able to do much. He's not really able to say much or provide much to them because, like, it's all stopped up inside of him. And he, you know, he's understandably upset and traumatized. But there is, like, he does have somewhat of a connection with the actress who turns out to be Jewish, whom he then sleeps with, and there's like this, there's this, it seems like there's this possibility, but of course nothing can really come of it. So yeah, I think that, I think that we're all essentially saying the same thing. Like we're not sure exactly if this, not only are we not sure if the novel posits a solution, we're not sure, you know, what the solutions could be. There seem to be these moments where people could almost connect but don't. And also, Hans, I wanted to say I agree with you that, like, this novel, like, I didn't choose this novel because I wanted necessarily to talk about, like, who we should side with. Like, I don't, like, I'm not even sure why we would need a conversation about that, to be honest. Like, I don't think that wasn't my, like, intention when picking the novel. It was more simply to pick something topical that, you know, connects with the real world. So, I don't want to move on if you have more to say.
I don't know. It kind of knits together the impotence and the lack of solutions. But just
right.
I did sort of mark this passage. This is after he's been held prisoner the first time in suspicion of colluding with Shemps in the murder that she commits.
Yeah.
Of Salim. Of Salim. And and he's kind of thinking, he's looking for her to basically warn her, and he can't find her. And the passage is, you say enough, and then blind history drags you by the hair back to war. I said enough and sunk into the massacre. I said enough and the war of the camps encircled me. I said enough and found myself crucified on the wall of an abandoned house in a village of ghosts called Majdalyun, whose inhabitants had been driven out. And now I say enough, and I find myself with a child in whom death dances exultantly, as though we were born and die in death. Again, that's kind of an example of several things we've talked about, I think.
Right.
There is an inability to do anything about your suffering.
Right.
That is pretty heavy and profound. Hans and Patrick, you were both going to say something.
You go, Hans.
I think I was just saying yeah.
Sure. But again, I think what you're pointing out, Chris, is great. You know, the book captures helplessness extremely well, I think. So there's, that the helplessness of so many characters. Maybe the exceptions are like Nahela and Shemps.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah, they're
next
both
question.
Yeah, they're both really interesting characters. Like, and both seem to be unwilling to accept. Well, Shemps seems unwilling to accept helplessness, and Nahela, she just doesn't ever seem helpless. Like, I'm thinking of that, the moment where she's before the Israeli officials, and they're like, you know, so are you married to Eunice, the terrorist criminal? She's like, no, what are you talking about? I'm a prostitute. And she just makes this shit up on the spot and, like, gets out of it, you know? Let's talk about your impressions of these two characters, whichever one you want to talk about.
I was going to say Shemp's, in particular, seems absolutely like mercurial and in a way that is like forceful. Like she, it's not that she takes the shape of like that's given to her. She leads troops. She's had a truly harrowing, abusive relationship with, her husband from a very young age. She's separated from her daughter, and I think that there is, God, maybe the novel just needs them because it's so bleak otherwise.
Right.
I don't, maybe that's if the question is almost a craft question, you could frame it like a craft question, like why
right.
it does, Shemp seem so important, and it's like you actually need something like a Shemp's in this novel to be a contrasting, sort of vividness to all the bleak bleak shit.
Yeah.
Not that her story isn't bleak, but
right.
Absolutely. Yeah, but she's vibrant.
Right. And like where we can easily imagine other people in her situation just folding, and tapping out, she's like, no, I'm gonna become a fighter, and screw this horrible husband. I'm gonna move on and eke out some kind of enjoyable life. In a small way, and I am going to fight and live, to the point that, she has the affair with Khalil while she's in love with someone else, and like she uses Khalil as like a kind of a stand-in or a surrogate for this person that she loves. And, maybe it does really mess up Khalil's psyche, but, what can you say? Okay, so this has been us discussing The Gate of the Sun, by Elias Khoury. As we've said, it's a big, harrowing, tragic novel that is oftentimes opaque. It's really hard to know if the author is doing much besides observing trauma and, trying to correctly represent trauma and how awful it is. So other than that, I'm not sure what other thematic statement we can pull out of this. So that's been our discussion. Chris, it's your pick is next. So I know we had discussed earlier about doing Underworld in three different parts. Is that still what we're doing, or have you decided to go in another direction?
No, I still would like to do that. I think if you guys are down to do kind of the first third-ish of Underworld, including, and we can kind of talk about, reference back to our episode on Pafko at the Wall.
Right.
That's the prologue. Go from there.
Okay. All right, listeners. So as you've heard from us, we are going to do Don DeLillo's Underworld. But we're going to do it. It's such a big novel. And, everybody, each of us has our own little little commitments in our greater lives. So we're going to divide it up into three equalish parts. So we're going to discuss the first part in our next episode. And we've already done the prologue, PAFCO at the Wall, and we'll reference that in our next discussion. So I hope you've enjoyed this discussion of Gate of the Sun. As limited as it may have been due to the podcaster's own ignorance, you know, which we apologize for. If you're more knowledgeable, feel free to hit us up and tell us what we said wrong. Or email us and say, you know, here's something cool that you missed. That'd be awesome. Peace out. Until next time, free Palestine.